What do you do if you're a conservative and you live in a blue city, in a blue state, where people call you names and don't like what you have to say, and other people want to read what you have to say, but they're too afraid to like it too much because, that's how tribal politics is. Well, we're going to talk to Dave Marcus at Blue Box Dave, writer for The Federalist and the New York Post. He's the New York correspondent for The Federalist, about Andrew Cuomo, Ted Cruz, cancel culture, and also the conservative convention in Florida, CPAC, and whether Donald Trump sets his mark and makes his mark and controls the Republican Party. Jeff Carlin is here, as always, the executive producer at WGN Radio. But unfortunately, Jeff, he's alive and he's not dead, but he has been incapacitated, and we'll explain it all the next time we come together on the Chicago Way. I want Jeff to explain it in his own words. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. Happy that John Lausch is staying, wondering about Mike Madigan, and J.B. Pritzker is screaming at me about being a fear monger, I assume. And where are you? With Dave Marcus in New York on the way to Florida, and J.B. Pritzker and Mike Madigan not knowing what they're doing. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Our guest, David Marcus, the New York correspondent for the Federalist and a writer of some renown, is one of my favorites. I read him all the time. You can find him on Twitter at Blue Box Dave. He's a conservative living in New York. And as a conservative in Chicago, I'm trying to get some survival tips from him. He's going to the CPAC convention for a day or so, and he'll tell us about that. And also, I want to know what's up with Cuomo. So hello, Dave, and welcome to the Chicago Way.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
So let me ask you, what's up with Cuomo?
Cuomo's in trouble. Cuomo, we've known for months and months now that something very fishy was going on with the numbers that were being reported from the nursing homes. I guess the face of it has been Fox News meteorologist Janice Dean, who lost her in-laws very early on in the pandemic. She's really kept a bright light on this, and some outlets like, the New York Post, where I also write, have kept the light on it. And now, about a month and a half ago, the Democratic, the very progressive, by the way, Democratic Attorney General of New York State, Letitia James, released a report saying that Cuomo basically lied and undercounted nursing home deaths by 50%, which is as many as, 9 or 10,000 people. In the meantime, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has now called for an investigation. There are Democrats in the Assembly who are calling for impeachment and taking away Cuomo's emergency powers, which quite frankly should have been done 10 months ago. This is a mess. I mean, the media is still trying to protect him, but that's hard to do when members of your own party are calling out your actions. So Cuomo's in some trouble here.
I find it interesting because he was propped up as an action figure, like an action figure doll during the campaign with the proviso that maybe he could be inserted in for the doddering Joe Biden, who is self-destructing as we speak. But now it seems like the progressives, the hard left, is going after him hammer and tongs. And it suggests to me a larger rift among the, they keep talking about a Republican civil war, and you've written a good piece on that, which we'll talk about. There is no Republican civil war. But among the Democrats, you can see this expression. This is the expression of it, where the hard left is savaged their liberal mayors during the riots, or I should say peaceful protests of the summer. And now we see it again in Cuomo. Am I overstating the case? If I am, please let me know.
No, I don't think you are at all. And, you know, something that you and I have, I think, spoken about in the past is that the Democratic Party, especially in big cities, is no longer the big machine that it once was. And Cuomo still operates as if he's the boss of big Democratic machine politics. But this is a post-machine political age, right? I mean, there was a time. One of the interesting stories that came out of this was that Cuomo apparently called up this state assemblyman, Ron Kim, to give him an earful, basically say, I'm going to destroy your career if you keep criticizing me. Now, that's something that 10 or 15 years ago might have worked, right? Not only in New York, but in places like Chicago. We all remember the stories of, you know, Rahm Emanuel naked at the gym, like sticking his finger into some guy's chest saying, you're going to toe the line, right? That's not how politics works anymore. Groups like the Justice Democrats, you know, these progressive groups that you're talking about, they can do an end run around the party machines that no longer have the kind of patronage operations that they once did. And I think Cuomo's learning that he's not the boss of the party the way his dad was in the 1980s. That time is over.
Also, the patronage, as the left, you know, attacked the old style patronage in all the big cities, using the federal courts to do it. Now they got rid of those old machines, and we're seeing, for example, in Chicago, the boss of bosses, Michael J. Madigan, has been removed from the speakership after, what, serving 40 years as speaker in the Illinois House. But in the place of those rumpled precinct workers come a new group, the teachers unions, the public employee unions, very progressive in Illinois and in New York, everywhere. And they become the new machine, right? So it's not really that the left has embraced virtue as much as it's just changed tactics and soldiers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, say what you will about, you know, the big party machines in places like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, right? These were often sort of like ethnically driven, you know, a lot of Irish, a lot of Polish, you know, the police unions instead of the teachers unions, right? And they were corrupt, but they didn't put communists on the city council. There were limits to what they would do. And when I look around the country now and I watch places like Minneapolis where they're voting to defund the police, when you listen to these city council people speak, it's perfectly obvious that they're wildly out of step with the vast majority of people in Minneapolis who aren't socialists, right? But these progressive organizations, as you say, have done a really remarkable job at plucking the low-hanging fruit, district attorneys races, right? And then they get these guys in there, like in LA, who just say, I'm not prosecuting anyone. So, Yeah, be careful what you wish for when you get rid of the big machines.
But they do have one advantage. The new machines, the new Trotsky, the new Bolsheviks devouring the Mensheviks now in the United States do have an ally. It's the our friend Dan Proft calls the champagne socialists in the suburbs. So the elitists in the suburbs with means, the leaders of the technocracy, are aligned with the hard left of the progressive unions in sort of in pursuit of political power in all these states. And without them, you know, they're the ones who send their children to private schools, have the means to do so, and then tell everybody else you can't have school choice.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that this touches on, I think this touches directly on why there actually isn't a Republican civil war going on. Because, you know, there was just new polling out today that shows that the Republican Party of Trump, that populist American first party that he created, has made enormous gains with Hispanic blue collar workers, right? So what is, you know, what do Liz Cheney and Mitch McConnell and Adam Kinzinger tell us the problem is, oh, we're losing suburban white women, right? We've got to go get them back. And these are the people you're describing. These are the people who have some money. These are the people who send their kids to school. These are the people who read books like White Fragility. but at the end of the day, you know, I look at that trade almost like, you know, if you're a basketball team and you've got an aging guy who's a pretty good scorer in suburban white women and you trade him for a bunch of draft picks, I think in the long run, the upside in courting, you know, blue collar and Hispanic and other minority voters, I mean, it's night and day. It's clearly the right direction. And I think pretty much everybody in the Republican Party knows that right now.
The every time I say Cuomo, the left here in Chicago responds with, "What about Cruz? What about Cruz?" And you have mentioned this. I think you've talked about whataboutism. Wasn't it a rule that the left imposed upon us years ago that we weren't supposed to engage in it, and then now they're engaging in it all the time?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's really, I mean, it is a nonsense term. I mean, the only way to engage in rational discussion about anything is to compare similar things and say, are we going to have one standard for them or are we going to have separate standards? And clearly we should have one standard. I mean, look, optically what Cruz did was bad. I don't know what
moronic
people. Moronic. Yeah, I mean, it was. But on the other hand, like, what was he supposed to do? I mean, was Ted Cruz supposed to be like, you know, up on a ladder fixing like electricity lines? Like, you know, I don't know that
he flying was, the like, helicopter with the
right. I don't know that there was much that Ted Cruz could do from Texas that he couldn't do from his phone in Cancun with his family. But yeah, I mean, it was an own goal. You know, and his communications team didn't do a great job of explaining it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, when you look at the numbers in terms of how places like CNN and MSNBC have covered Cruz's Cancun vacation compared to Cuomo's, you know, genocide of the elderly, it's nuts. I mean, it's
is there a place that listeners here to the Chicago Way can go to look at these comparisons, these number comparisons? There doesn't seem to be a clearinghouse that I can trust without some suspect, you know, motives to assess that.
One resource that's pretty good for that kind of thing is a website, and they also have a Twitter account called Grabian. It's a couple years old. It was started by a guy named Tom Elliott. And really what they do is they aggregate all the news coverage, and they'll show you quite often what's being reported on which channel. I spend most of my day bopping back and forth between Fox News and CNN because I need to see what both sides are saying.
Right.
I mean, it's night and day, and it's part and parcel of the great divisions that we have in this country. And it's not just on cable news, right? I mean, the New York Times and the New York Post at this point are describing two completely different universes. And that's just the, for better or worse, that's the world that we live in now. Now, listen, I think that this whole notion that there ever was objective news is a little suspect, right? I mean, there were gatekeepers back in the day. And that gave the illusion that what you watched on the three channels of the 6:30 news was just the facts, but it was never really just the facts.
The gatekeepers were the three major networks, Cronkite and those folks.
Yep.
And several major newspapers. They all leaned liberal. They all leaned to the left. And they would congratulate Republicans who capitulated. The Republican congressional leadership in the United States when I was a boy was always congratulated for, you know, going along and doing what was right for the country while they collapsed and refused to fight the all-important cultural wars battle that we have apparently lost. If you look
it's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, I experienced this firsthand, about 2.5 years ago. I sort of had a brief flirtation with the New York Times where I had run a couple columns with them. Right. And I had sat down and had a meeting with then opinion page editor, James Bennett, who got run out of town last year for running a Tom Cotton article suggesting that we use the National Guard for riots. And now there's like 8 million National Guard in Washington, D.C., and everybody seems to think it's fine. But, you know, when I sat down with Bennett, I was very interested in trying to bring a conservative voice to the pages of the New York Times. And what I discovered and what I've spoken to other writers who experienced exactly the same thing is just what you say. When I would offer them something that was critical of conservatism from a conservative perspective, they were all over it, right? Yes, they couldn't wait to run it.
Right.
The moment that I offered them something that was sort of unabashedly conservative, I got a dial tone. They just didn't want it. That became very clear, very fast. I'm much happier now at the New York Post, where that's clearly not the case. An organization that I think over the past couple of years has developed one of the best and most robust opinion pages in the country.
Great opinion page editor.
Yeah, so Rob Amari is really one of the leading intellectual lights of the new right, and he's put together a great page. But it's exactly as you say. The job of Republicans for the liberal media is to constantly apologize and constantly do exactly what Liz Cheney and Mitch McConnell did, which is, you know, claim ridiculously that Trump incited this riot when we all know that that's not true. And by the way, I don't know if you had a chance to watch that Senate testimony yesterday about the Capitol riots, but I mean, it couldn't be clearer now that nobody was anticipating this.
Based on the intelligence, we all believed that the plan met the threat and that we were prepared. We now know that we had the wrong plan.
We properly planned for a mass demonstration with possible violence. What we got was a military-style coordinated assault on my officers and a violent takeover of the Capitol building. I acknowledge that under the pressure of an unprecedented attack, a number of systems broke down.
We are speaking to David Marcus, New York correspondent for The Federalist, columnist for The New York Post, which runs his columns and occasionally mine as well. I need to ask you something, David. As you were mentioning Bennett and The New York Times and the woke newsroom there that ran him out, I had a similar issue here. Where I was accused of, I was defamed by my own union, which I'm not a member, of being an anti-Semite for daring to suggest that George Soros funded Kim Fox and a bunch of other let him go prosecutors throughout the country. And I need to know from you, from your perspective in New York, do you have any like survival tips or skills that conservatives need to develop if they live in a blue progressive city or state?
Well, listen,
I'm wondering scotch. I was thinking scotch would be good, but you know, you can't do it all the time.
No, you know, you at least want to wait till an appropriate hour of the day. You can always negotiate what that is exactly. But no, listen, I thought that your response, I remember that situation quite well. And I thought that your response was the model. I certainly took it as my own model. You can't back down to it. We see this time and again, the moment that you apologize, it's over, right? And this has to do with all of the cancel culture stuff, right? Like, look at a figure like J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, who gets into all this trouble because, you know, she seems to believe that men can't just magically become women. She was expected to apologize and say, oh, my goodness, I was so insensitive. And she said, no, I'm not doing it. And the moment you do that, or you do what you did and just defend yourself, the other side kind of crumples because they don't have anything.
Well, they continue to defame people. They continue to put it out on social media to defame people that they and diminish. But I guess the thing is, I'm more concerned not about me or you, but I'm concerned about families, people, and citizens who are terrified. They don't write for the New York Post or the Chicago Tribune. And they're terrified that if they say the wrong thing at work, or if they say the wrong thing during their struggle sessions, on Zoom, when they meet with HR and everyone pretends not to drink Coke, or I guess are they supposed to drink Coke now and talk about their fragility and their whiteness and so forth? And these people are terrified. They're afraid, and they're young people. They're younger than you, younger, and you're young, but younger than you, and they're in their 20s, and I know them. I know some of them. I know my own kids are concerned. Yeah.
I mean, listen, that's a responsibility that you and I have. I have a colleague at the Federalist named John Daniel Davidson, who's down in Texas. He does wonderful reporting about the border. Just, he's our political editor, and you know, he's smart as a whip. And he said to me recently, he was like, listen, Dave, exactly to your point, he said, you know, these people are terrified. They can't speak up. The Federalist isn't going to fire us. The New York Post isn't going to fire you. You're in a position to be able to try to speak for these people and let them know that they're not crazy. And that's what you've got to do. And you're going to get, you know, like you say, you and I will get slammed for that. But that's what we get paid for.
Yeah, I'm not worried about me. I really don't give two figs.
Yeah,
what others say about me. I'm really concerned about young people who are terrified. They're like lost in some sort of North Korea, but it's in the United States, where they can't even say, "Hey, wait a minute. What? Why not? Why can't we choose the person? The person with the greatest merit should get the promotion, right?" You know, they can't even dare even think it.
Yeah. And you know, the only antidote to it is for those who are in a position to speak up, I find that really is effective. I mean, I think that's something that happened back in May with regard to the lockdowns. There was a moment in sort of mid-May. It was after Florida and Georgia had opened, and we had been promised like these numbers or these, you know, this is going to be just death upon death upon death. They opened, the numbers didn't move the way we were promised by all of these experts that they would. And something happened in conservative media where a bunch of people suddenly said, I don't care if you accuse me of killing grandma, I'm going to criticize these lockdowns now.
Right.
And the moment that outlets like the New York Post and the moment that you know, people like Tucker Carlson got on and said what you weren't supposed to be allowed to say.
Right.
We all realize, wait a minute, there's a ton of people who think this. Right. And I don't know if you ever, I assume that you get this, but the most satisfying response that I ever get from readers is when they'll send me an email saying one of two things, either what you wrote is what I think, I just didn't quite know how to express it, or what you wrote is what I think and I was afraid to express it. That's the best response you can ever get, because that's a columnist's job. It's not a reporter's job. It's columnist's job. And we need to see with the eyes of the people, and we need to speak with the voice of the people.
And their hearts. And
yes.
Just the other day, you did a piece called, let me get the headline, 1 year later, our answer to lockdowns must be never again. This was in the Federalist, I believe, February 23rd. And I ask all of you listening to go to the Federalist and Google David Marcus and read his stuff. There's a part in this column. Americans have been told they cannot run their businesses, they cannot go to church, they cannot gather with families, they cannot attend cultural events, their children cannot be educated in schools, they cannot go outside without masks. To make matters worse, in most states, these restrictions on basic life were not produced through normal legislative or political process, but by emergency powers granted to dictatorial governors, and I would add, like Cuomo or Pritzker. That was a great piece, David. You're exhorting people to stand up like America, to get off your knees or their knees and stand up like Americans.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I mean, I think maybe the most underreported story of the last year is the unprecedented extent to which Americans have been not governed, but really ruled by these governors, where the state legislatures just said back in March, okay, you guys do whatever you want. And my fear, my biggest fear is that it's a dress rehearsal, right? That yes. There's always going to be a reason to do this. There's always going to be some scary thing in the closet that we need to be protected from. And one of the other things I said in that column, and it wasn't easy for me to write, but later in that column, I said, this is the first time that America's ever felt old and feeble and not courageous to me. And we can't have that. I mean, we especially can't have that at a time when China is challenging us all across the globe. I mean, we've got to be tougher than this.
But the I hate to put it in terms of castration, okay, even sure. On a podcast, but the enfeeblement of the American culture is running parallel to the rise of the left and the deconstruction of everything from statues to, look, we're getting rid of Lincoln, for God's sake, and Leif Erikson in the Chicago parks. And the deconstruction of the family, the deconstruction of virtue, basically, of virtue. And when Rome lost its virtues, we know what happened. And this is the same thing. I see it. I see
yes.
It that way.
And it is very much related to the rise of Donald Trump and the way in which he was able to take over the GOP. One of the things I've been focused on for a while and trying to think about what this new right is going to look like, because we're clearly not going back to Mitt Romney Chamber of Commerce establishmentism, right? I mean, that's right. that day's over.
My name so is Reek. My name is Reek.
Yeah. So, you know, I kind of look to the past, and the touchstone for me was really the 92 election. And there were two figures in the 1992 election who I think anticipated Trump in a way. The most obvious was Perot, right? And Perot was, you know, against these big trade deals. He was laser focused on American jobs. He was skeptical of immigration. He didn't want foreign wars. I mean, you can run down the checklist of things that match up with Trump's America First policies, right?
Right.
But the other figure was Pat Buchanan.
Yes.
And if you remember, you know, Buchanan launches this challenge against George H.W. Bush that was very much based on these cultural issues.
Yes.
And he did well enough to get himself that speech at the 92 convention.
You wrote about this. Yeah, it was hilarious.
It's still a controversial speech, right? To this day, it's a controversial speech. But Buchanan understood, like, Americans care about these cultural issues. They care about the statues. They care about the family. They care about all this stuff. And I'm not convinced that Mitch McConnell does. I am convinced that Donald Trump does. And I think that's a huge difference.
The piece that David Marcus, our guest, has written is, there is no GOP civil war. The supposed schism in the Republican Party is a media fantasy. But David, I have to say, the people like Romney and Mitch McConnell are the establishmentarians of the Republican Party. These are the ones who most often cut deals with Democrats against the interests of the people that I'm writing for, the people you're writing for, the people that aren't perhaps the most sophisticated in the world. They're not fancy people. They're the ones that Strzok and Page of the FBI mocked in the Walmart. But they're Americans, and they have honor and dignity, and that's been stripped from them by a succession of policies, economic policies that took away their jobs, sent them to China, and so forth. How does Mitch McConnell hold on to the Republican Party when the base of the Republican Party has shifted away from him?
I mean, the short answer is that he doesn't, he doesn't for very long. He can have his leadership position. Liz Cheney can have her leadership position. That's all well and good. But when you look just at the pure numbers of what Republicans want, what kind of elected officials they want, there's clearly been a sea change. And they clearly want something much closer to the populist vision of Donald Trump than the post-Cold War neoliberal GOP that we've had for the last 30 years. That shift isn't going to change. You know, I'd add one more thing to what you say about these supposedly unsophisticated Americans. You know, I remember growing up, you know, my grandfather went to World War II. He came back, never went to college. Mm-hmm. But I remember when he retired, I'd go over and he'd just be sitting on the porch with a stack of books from the library,
right,
about the Civil War,
right,
right? About the Cold War, about, right, politics. And there was an engagement that's still there. And I think that we live in a media environment now where you're absolutely right. Like, people think that the guy who you know, drives the garbage truck is some kind of, like, illiterate idiot.
Or
it's not true today. It's never been true.
It's never been true. But the attitude in media, looking down your nose at a tradesman, electrician, a plumber, you know, the people that actually keep you alive.
Yep.
It's sickening to me. And I see it reflected on television, in the newsprints, everywhere. Not in the Federalist, not in the Post. I do see it reflected elsewhere, though, and it bothers me because it's not even smart politics. If you take a dog, and Jeff and I have talked about this, you take a dog and you can force a dog into a corner with sharp sticks, but sooner or later you're going to find that you've chosen a wolf, and the wolf will not cower and won't lie down. And that's what all this that we're talking about seems to want to promote or spark, is the exact thing that they say they're against. And it's problematic, and it's unsettling.
Yeah, I don't anymore, but for the first several years that I was working as a columnist, I was also working part-time as a mover here in New York. And Being a mover in New York's a pretty tough job, man. We got a lot of stairs. Not as many elevators as you might want. And, you know, sometimes a sleeper sofa has to go up five flights. But when I would sit in the truck with those guys, and these were not guys for the most part who went to college. These were guys, you know, real diverse set of guys. I mean, we'd chop it up about all this stuff, about politics, about culture, about everything.
Right.
And these were smart guys. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, this attitude now that we have that we have to just listen to experts all the time. You know, I mean, can't we really be done with that now? It's the great Irish writer A.E. His actual name is George Russell. I always mess up his actual. It was early 19th century, you know, Irish nationalist writer. And he had a great line that's often misattributed to Churchill, where he said experts should be on tap, not on top. Right on tap.
Say it again. Say it again, because I laughed and people. I will say it again.
He says experts should be on tap, not on top. That yes, of course we need experts to tell us, you know, things that we don't know.
Right.
But then ultimately we're a free people who have to take that information and make political choices, and we have to do that as the people. And yeah, I mean we're moving away from that. And again, that's exemplified by the fact that for a year, we've had these Lord Protector governors, who do whatever they want. And what's interesting about that, and I think what's important about that, is governors don't do constituent services, right? If you're a restaurant owner in Staten Island or in some neighborhood in Chicago, right, and you're about to lose your business because you're not allowed to open. If you gather 25 restaurant owners and show up at your state assemblyman's office, you're going to get some attention from them. If you show up in Albany and try to get the governor's attention, they don't do that. Right? And that's a problem. There's no place for you to go.
You are going to a state in a few days as we're recording this. We're speaking with David Marcus, one of the best in the business. He writes for The Federalist, New York Post, other magazines, and find him at Blue Box Dave. You're going to a state that is a free state. I guess we could call it that now. A free state in Florida, where the conservative convention will be held. What is it called? CPAC? I keep thinking, because I have sleep apnea, I keep confusing it with my machine. What do you anticipate from there with you're saying that there's no civil war in the Republican Party? I happen to agree with you, although Mike Pence is not going to attend. Trump will attend. What will come out of it?
Well, look, I mean, CPAC has always been very pro-Trump. What's interesting about this particular CPAC is that the lineup is really heavily slated with legislators. You know, people like Ted Cruz, people like Josh Hawley, right? These people who are going to seek to carry on, like Governor Ron DeSantis of the free state of Florida, right? People who are going to try to carry on the populist vision of the GOP. So, I mean, that's what you always see at CPAC. That's what you're going to see at CPAC. The point is that there's no anti-CPAC, right? I mean, Mitt Romney and Mitch McConnell are not, you know, can't get 20,000 people to show up someplace to celebrate the idea of trade deals with China and sending more troops to Iraq, right? It doesn't exist. But, you know, to your point about the free state of Florida. About 2.5 weeks ago, I was down in Texas, and I was in Austin, which is a pretty liberal part of Texas. But even in Austin, I mean, it was night and day compared to New York City, or compared to what I saw back in December when I was in Chicago.
Yeah, we missed each other. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, no, but you know, the thing you know, it's been tough in New York. I mean, it really has, especially once it got cold. I mean, this city is not built, like, we don't have apartments big enough to have 15 people over for a party, right? We sleep in our apartments and then we go out.
Right.
That's how New York City's built. That's how it operates. I'm sure Chicago's a little different, but not that dissimilar in that it's a social town, right? It's been dark and depressing and hard. It's been hard on our kids who still aren't in school and in particularly meaningful ways in the public schools. And then you look at a place like Florida or a place like Texas where the opposite is happening, and it almost feels like two Americas.
If you go to Greece or Italy in the summer, you can see the people with expressions on their faces, the people who live there, right, in those places. They have happy expressions. They're looking up, except when there's economic catastrophe. But, I mean, generally, they have expressions on their faces. And then you see the Americans or the Europeans coming from the cold countries, and they have gray faces, like Russians from the 1950s. And I assume that it would be like that in Florida, where all the conservatives gather and they'll be stunned. Those who don't know it will be stunned by the freedom. And it'll be like a time machine, Dave. It'll be like a time machine.
And that's why it's there, right? I mean, they've been doing CPAC. I know the first CPAC was in 1974. That happened to be the year I was born. Since 1974, it's always been in Washington, D.C., which makes sense, right? Like, where else would it be? Right. And this is why it's not in Washington, D.C., because you can't. It's just not allowed. Occupied Washington, D.C. is not in 2021 a place where Americans of goodwill can gather together to petition their government or to join forces, as Americans have done for hundreds of years. And that's really sad.
It looks like a John Le Carré novel in Washington with the razor wire. David Marcus, last question. Will Trump dominate? I mean, he'll make a speech there. Will his message dominate, whatever he happens to say, or will the argument by the CPAP about cancel culture, which is the theme of their convention, dominate? What will come out of it?
Axios reported earlier this week that Trump is going to make a speech where he sort of asserts himself as still being the leader of the Republican Party. I'm a little skeptical that it's going to be quite that direct. I could be wrong. I mean, maybe he will. I think it's an open question as to what he wants to do in terms of 2024. He's in a unique position. I don't know that in modern political history, we've had a figure like him, a sort of ex-president who's in a position to spend a decade or so as the kingmaker, right? Maybe that could have been Bill Clinton if he hadn't been impeached. Maybe it's Obama to some extent in the Democratic Party, although it's not the same, right? So, look, we've never seen in our lifetimes, I think, a takeover of a political party the way Trump took over the GOP. So, I mean, it's his party. It's a new party. Whether that means that he is the sort of titular figurehead of it, or whether that means that he's more behind the scenes promoting people who are going to be running primaries and consolidating his influence, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that he knows yet. And I think that whatever he says at CPAC and whatever the response to it is, could very well inform him and his allies about what the best way forward is.
David Marcus, you'll find him on Twitter at Blue Box Dave. You'll find him in the New York Post, at The Federalist, at many other publications. Find him. He's a smart writer, and sometimes he even tweets out bizarre stuff about food. but I'm not going to go there. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, John.
When you come back. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me. What a great chat.
Bye, buddy. For David Marcus at Blue Box Dave, writer for The Federalist, The New York Post, which sometimes carries my column, and other publications. It was just a great, great time to talk to them. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of WGN Radio, Jeff's not feeling well. He's still struggling. He's still helping us behind the scenes, but we'll tell you all about what happened to him. He's alive. Don't worry. He's not dead. And he'll tell you all about what happened to him on our next edition. Thanks for being here. Remember, subscribe on iTunes and give us a 5-star review, and we'll give you a City Asphalt contract if we can. You've been with us on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.